Well, that's so. This afternoon, or no, this morning we return to settling the mind at natural state, slipping ahead a little bit. But I'll preface this by saying that I'm really not satisfied with the response that I gave to Jen's question yesterday, asking if anger relates back to the emergence of anger relates back to luminosity of the substrate and so forth. How does fear fit in? And I said, well, fear just simply obscures the substrate. I would give myself a B minus on that answer, because ill will also obscures the substrate. Yeah, there's no question about that. But its nature is luminosity. Sensual craving obscures the substrate, but it still traces back to the substrate in the form of bliss, right? So when we see the nature, when we can probe into the nature of sensual craving, form of attachment, then we see the bliss is there. When we look into ill will, anger, resentment, we see the luminosity is there. And as I reflected a little bit further on this, fear also is a response. As anger is a response to something we don't like, fear is a response to something that we don't like that hasn't happened yet. So they're very much in the same category. And then if we reflect upon this in experience, what's the nature of fear? Well, of course, biologically, the adrenals, the big shifts in the body, the muscles, the blood flows to the legs and so forth, it's quite clear that when we look into the nature of fear, which of course obscures anxiety, of course it obscures the nature of the substrate consciousness, but when we look into its nature, there it is, its luminosity. Fear really wakes us up. You can't be really bored and afraid at the same time, right? And so I think that's it. So it's going to be in that same category as anger. It's a response to something we don't want, and anger, in case maybe we've already got it, but I think its nature is luminosity. It's really bright, it's sharp, it's clear. But that's not to say it's intelligent. Not to say that it's intelligent. It's just the sheer luminosity, and that sheer luminosity can then be filtered through all kinds of layers of delusion. So paranoia can be very, very, very bright, but it's completely saturated by delusion. Okay? Now I give myself a higher grade than B minus. Moving on to our practice today, the third phase of this mind, of this settling the mind in its natural state, I also want to stop using a term that I have used in the past. This came up just in one of the one-on-one meetings, and that is that as we're settling the mind in its natural state, we are not entering into a mode of free association. I've often used that is a little bit similar to lying on the couch and, okay, what comes to mind? Oh, my mother, and she reminds me of this, and that reminds me of that. And so just letting the mind rove around like a dog roving around in a park or in a garbage dump. But it's actually not like that. It's not like that. Because if any of us right now should say, okay, think of green. What does green remind you of? Apples. What does apple remind you of? Pie. Pie reminds me of, geometry. Geometry reminds me, and on you go. So what is that? That's just a whole string of pearls of individual thoughts held together with a string of grasping. It's all the coherence of that. The connections is all held together with grasping. This practice is to be free of grasping. So this is not free association, right? So where we'll be focusing on this morning is not just the space of the mind, as I mentioned yesterday afternoon, but we're simply making sure that we include the space of the mind, that we still have something to attend to, even when no distinct thoughts, images, and so forth are arising. And so to be attending closely to that space of the mind, which is most evident during the intervals between thoughts and images and the like, quite interesting. Especially as we start to fine-tune the attention to enhance the qualitative vividness, the selcha, of the attention. That on the one hand, a thought may come in that's something nagging you, something that you've ruminated about in the past, and it's coming in again, the same old thing, right? About the future, the past, oh, this thought again, oh, that image again. You know, same old, same old. And it's real, and it influences the mind. Maybe it brings distress or anxiety, or maybe it brings some craving and whatever. So those are kind of real thoughts that arise, real then. And as they arise, we really engage with them. Momentarily, at least, there's a bit of grasping onto them. Perhaps they even flick over into a bit of association. And yes, this reminds me of that, and what about that? And then it sputters out and dissolves back into the space of the mind. But for a while, they're real. And all I mean by real is they really have causal efficacy. Not that it's inherently real, but in one of the more basic Buddhist philosophies, Dodepa, or Satrantika, something is considered real if it has causal efficacy, if it influences anything else, and if it in turn has arisen in dependence upon prior causes and conditions. So for us living in this world, that's about as real as it gets. Dreams are real. Dreams can make you wake up feeling terrible or euphoric and what have you. And so there are some of these thoughts that are really quite real in that sense, that they really impact us, right? And then, as you relax more deeply, and you're taking a greater interest and more finely attending to that space of the mind, that relative Dharma Dhatu, and it's just empty, you may very well witness very, very fleeting events coming up. Images that if you could just have a mental stopwatch, a chronometer, you might think, wow, that was a 20 millisecond flash. Oh, 15 millisecond flash. Oh, 30 millisecond flash. Oh, that was 500 milliseconds. You know, but you'll find them incredibly short, fleeting, thin, lightweight, just appearances. Images, a little discursive thought, but they flicker. They just flicker in and out. And moreover, from flicker one to flicker two, 3 seconds later, no apparent connection at all. It's called stochastic. Because I've studied physics, I like the parallels, and I speak of them only poetically. I'm not trying to draw some deep ontological parallels here, but it's kind of acute. I think it's interesting ontological parallel, and that is some of you might recall my real focus of research as an undergraduate at Amherst in physics was I got really intrigued about the energy of empty space. And so I spent about 2 years studying that and did the mathematics for it, calculated its density, and then wrote a whole thesis that was really centered on that theme. But the whole idea that space itself, when you take out all possible matter and energy out of a volume of space, even theoretically, even imagine taking out gravitational energy, which you can't do, but as a thought experiment, you can. So imagine you've taken out of space all known forms of energy and matter that can, you know, possibly can. Right in the very nature of space itself, there is this energy that is intrinsic to space, and it's called the zero-point energy of space, or more technically, the zero-point energy of the electromagnetic vacuum. Well, the cool thing about this is where you fuse special relativity with quantum mechanics, is that in that field, in space itself, virtual particles will arise very briefly. They'll just come out of empty space, and they'll just go, beep, boop, like, hi, come on. And by the time you want to say hi back, they're gone, you know. So they just flicker in and they flicker out. And it has to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that the conservation of energy principle can be violated. Can be violated. The shorter the violation, the larger the amount of energy can come up and vanish. The longer the violation occurs, the less quantity of energy can be violated. So there are major physicists that believe that the whole universe emerged from a flux in the vacuum of the space of the universe, and out of that emerged the energy mass of the entire universe, that it simply, we're here as a quantum fluctuation. So that's a little bit of physics. I got pretty interested in it 25 years ago, and the interest lingers a little bit. But these other particles that are not strung together with association, this reminds me of this, oh, I don't like thinking about that, oh, that's cool, I like that. You know, these become real because of grasping. But these ones, when you're really not grasping, you're just present like space. I've heard that before. Like space, your awareness, like space, observing space, that these just images, thoughts, just in and out. We can call them virtual thoughts, virtual images. They just briefly emerge out of the space of the mind and they dissolve right back into it with no clutching onto them, with hardly a ripple. Now, do they have any causal efficacy? Yeah, a little bit. Not much. Enough that you notice them, right? And so settle in a great deal of looseness, of relaxation, and observe that space of the mind. And observe these events, because I don't think my mind is unique here. They just flicker in and out. They can appear in different parts of space, But their thinness, in the sense that there's no real substance to them. They're just these appearances coming and going and dissolving right back in, but often very, very briefly. And stochastically, you're watching the zero point, the manifestations of the zero point energy of the space of your own mind. Kind of cool. Yeah. All right. So the technique, because I mustn't overlook it, the technique, subtle body, speech, and mind, bring this quality of awareness to the field of the body, the space of the body, whatever arises. See whether there are any virtual events arising in the space of the body. Who knows? Maybe there'll be little flickerings of tactile sensations arising in the somatic space. So just kind of get used to it, because it's easier for most people, easier to attend to the space of the body and the tactile events arising and passing within that space. So kind of get yourself grounded in space of the body. And then, as usual, shift your awareness to the space of the mind, taking a special interest in those space-time intervals between thoughts. They are intervals, they are periods of time, but they're also space, because you're looking right through it, like looking through a window that just opened. The opening is the time, and you're looking to the space that's revealed between those two thoughts, during the intervals of thoughts. And just see what you see. And in between sessions, I'll say this, so maybe say nothing at the end. In between sessions, you might also linger sometimes just attending to the, not only the space of the mind as much as you can, but actually attending to visual space. Because that too is not a sheer nothingness. The space in which visual events arise and vanish, the space between where you sense you are and where visual objects are, that space, that too is not a sheer nothingness. It's also all full of energy. So that's it. Find a comfortable position. Lasso. In these last three mornings, I didn't mention the gentle Voss breathing, but you might want to experiment with that at least now and again to see whether it's helpful. A number of people have actually commented to me that they do find it rather grounding, and do indeed find that the energies do start to converge into the center, which is a good thing. And more of you can do it when you're sitting. I do not recommend when you're in supine or lying down at all, but standing or supine, even walking, it can be done. And it kind of gives you that groundedness. It can be helpful. Then finally, I thought you might be interested in something of a newsflash that I read yesterday. Michelle knows that I'm up to something tricky. I had been under the impression for quite a long time that there were about 100 billion stars in our Milky Way, in our galaxy. I read yesterday that I've been wrong. I've been laboring under a false impression for quite some time now. It turns out there's about 200 billion stars. So you can imagine what that does to the property values. You know, I mean suddenly, you know, there's just a lot more land. And scientists over the last 20 years have discovered about 500 exoplanets, planets around other suns, that now they just come up with an indirect evidence that there may be actually more planets in the galaxy than there are stars. An awful lot of them. An awful lot of them. So if you don't like the way things are turning out on Earth, you know, and you're considering future plans, you might consider some other. It seems like there's a lot of planets to choose from, you know. And then there's this issue of property values. So it's food for thought. Not much, but a little bit. Enjoy your day.